I wanted to learn about the environmental history of Illinois, so I learned about the advent of European descent peoples into Illinois in the late 1600s, and the farming practices, the nature of the rivers at that time, how the rivers have since changed. I learned a great deal about concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, and I learned a great deal about recent thought in critical animal studies.
Well, one of the things you say early on in your book is the amount of land that was prairie mm-hmm. in Illinois and yeah. what's left.
Right. So 3/4 of the state was wetlands. And now less than, I think, 1% is, 0.4%. And the history of that change is mind-boggling. Without exception, Pierre de Liet, Marquette, Joliet, LaSalle, when they came through, they said that Illinois was the most remarkably beautiful land between the mouth of the St. Lawrence and the mouth of the Mississippi. And it isn't now, obviously. There's something profoundly, and I don't mean to sound prejudicial about the place I live, but ugly. And I wanted to understand how that happened and why it happened.
It would seem that that topic would be better suited for a nonfiction prose work, but yet you managed to put it in poetry. Was that difficult?
Well, I happen to feel that poetry is essentially just nonfiction. So it has a great deal of similarities. It has a lot of homologies with nonfiction anyway. So, and most of that book is lyric essay, historiographic prose poetry, what I call historiographic prose poetry. There are a few lineated poems in it. So it does have a lyricism to it, but a great deal of it is nonfiction.
What were some of the discoveries that you made for yourself personally about animal practices?
The degree to which we manufacture apathy about other animals, it's something we actually practice, I think, at a semi-conscious, non-conscious level. And part of that apathy is really a kind of antipathy. There is an actual anger almost toward non-human beings in a funny way. And you see this in slaughterhouses, and you see it in CAFOs, the way that animals are treated there. So that was really surprising to me, the remarkable degree to which we don't want to look at our eating practices and what we need to do. We need to sustain the kind of brutality and apathy in order to eat that way.
Do you personally practice veganism or vegetarianism?
Yeah, I have since 2010. I've been an ethical vegan since 2010, so I don't eat any animal products. And, the American Dietetic Association and so many other organizations just flat out claim that it's an optimal diet and there's nothing wrong with it. There are a great many myths about why we eat, the protein myth. Everybody gets enough protein. It's a rare person. They'd have to be somehow on some kind of strange diet to not get enough proteins. And I actually like food more. My heart rate dropped 10 beats a minute. My blood pressure improved markedly.
Getting back to the writing, your book moves between poetry and prose.
Mm-hmm.
Is that difficult to do as a writer?
No, it's not, actually. And it's interesting the way that we train creative writers. We train them typically in one genre. But it really is an unusual thing for writers to do, to limit themselves to one particular genre. If you look just historically at the nature of authorship, you know, authors really they did have a fluency between different genres. And it's only recently that we've specialized in whatnot. One of the things we do in the creative writing program here at ISU is specialize in hybridity, transgeneric writing, cross-generic writing. And we encourage our students to really not stick to one genre, but to, as much as possible, blend and to experiment.
Your earlier book, A Rhode Island Notebook, was also pretty strange for a poetry collection because
right.
it's essentially a travelogue of you mm-hmm. going back and forth to Rhode Island to mm-hmm. see your daughter,
right.
your little girl. It's what you see on the way in the car mm-hmm. and sometimes musing about the history of the places that you're going through. What prompted you to write that in that way?
I was driving to see my daughter to try to maintain a connection with her during a failing relationship with her mother. I didn't have the money to fly. So I would spend 18 hours every one way. So 36 hours every week I would drive on the weekends and see her for a few hours. And I thought I needed to use this time. And I'd always wanted to write a notebook. I was fascinated with the genre of the notebook and the eclectic nature of what gets included in a notebook and the kind of interesting conjunctions that happen in notebooks. And so I set out with some deliberateness to write a notebook. And so you see in that book collagic elements. I mean, radio snippets, audiobook stuff. There are just some straight essays in there. There are a lot of drafts of first poems, things that I would never publish otherwise. It was a lot of embarrassing things from a craft perspective in that book. And it does have some footnotes and whatnot in it. It is a mishmash of different paratextual features.
Yeah. Some have likened it to On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
Do you like that comparison or not?
It's a flattering comparison in that Kerouac was a consecrated writer. I have to say I've never read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Obviously, it's nice to be compared to previous writers, especially those that are canonical. So, yeah, of course, that's flattering.
Your work is very intellectual. It's at times very dense and very personal. It's sometimes difficult as a reader to enter into these poems. Some people say this is what's wrong with poetry, right? Because it's not accessible. They can't access the meaning.
Yeah. I think it's important to write in a number of different registers. One of the things that art has going for it is its difficulty. This guy, Viktor Shklovsky, a Russian critic in 1917, wrote a really fine essay called Art as Device, in which he says that one of the important jobs of an artist is to put difficulty into the work, whatever it's painting or poetry, to, as he says, make the stone stony again, to put purposeful strangeness into a piece of writing, to pull the reader out of their common habits of perception. The idea is that we tend to live in routine and automated ways. We live our lives with too much habit, conceptual habit and behavioral habit. And what art does is it reminds us that the stone is stony. And to do that, you need to make the reader slow down. And Yeats would talk about what he called the fascination with what's difficult. Certainly writers take that too far at times, and I you know, perfectly am happy to say I willingly risk that.
Is there some way that readers should read these poems, or you recommend that they read these poems? Is there some Rosetta Stone to getting more meaning out of the poems that can seem very personal?
Yeah, there is a code that some people are going to be more privy to and some people are not. But, you know, I have to meet the reader halfway, you know, and if I don't do that well, I've failed. And I know that a lot of my work has failed. It's just, you know, like it's to this or it's to that. Sometimes I hit it on the mark, I think. You know, it's a struggle for any writer. You can't win them all. You just have to keep trying and experimenting. And I think it's important to always try to push oneself.
Your earliest book was called In Defense of Poetry.
Mm-hmm.
How do you defend poetry? Why is poetry important?
Poetry is important because it helps us see the world and feel the world after we've forgotten about it. We tend to, you know, we have so many distractions in our life. And that's the purpose of art, I think. It's to help us, it's to uncover. It does a certain kind of cultural work. It helps us uncover what's important. Poetry needs no defense. It's its own defense.
What is the famous W.H. Auden quote? Poetry changes nothing, it survives.
Oh, I like that. There is this charge against poetry that I do tend to agree with. It can be quietistic, it can be politically quietistic, but I think it should get down there and to teach us things, ethical things, political things. I think it has a huge pedagogical task, and that's the role of literature. I think it's to help us face what we don't want to face.
We've been talking with Professor Gabriel Gooding. He is a Redbird Scholar this year from Illinois State University. We've been talking about his collections of poems and his essays. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about poetry.
Thank you, Judy. It was a pleasure.
I'm Judy Valente.